All right, so as I mentioned, we're looking at, I think I got part two, I think it's actually part three, I forgot to change that, but we're into the next, or this last section on looking at grace, and can a Christian fall from grace? We've looked at the questions of, does God's grace cover all of our sins? And the answer, of course, is yes, but can a Christian then fall from God's grace and back into sin? And the obvious question that we've looked at, or the answer to that from a biblical standpoint, is yes. We see that clearly in Scripture. And so we must be aware of that and aware of where we stand. Are we in God's grace or out? At what point does it continue, at what point does God's grace cease to cover our sin? And as we noted last week, or 2 weeks ago, was when we leave God's grace, it no longer covers us. When we sin unrepentantly, we have fallen from God's grace. Can I know if I'm saved from my sin? That was another question we've looked at, and the answer is yes. You can know if you're in God's grace or not. And I'll invite you to please go back and look at any of those lessons for further details, explanations of those answers. Finally, how can I safeguard my life from falling from grace? And so that's what I'm going to look at tonight for just a couple of minutes, and we'll move into our next next question. All right, so how can I safeguard myself? I'm going to give you three ways I think are needful. You probably can add to these, but these are the ones that are on my mind. Number one, I think it's very important that you and I be honest with ourselves about where we are weak. We can lie to ourselves and convince ourselves of many things that just simply are not true. Or we can live in denial of things that are true about ourselves. And so we need to learn to be honest with who we are, where we have weak spots, and those are the places we need to try to strengthen. Again, James chapter 1, 14 and 15, we've referred to this many times, but here James tells us that when we fall, it comes from where? Verse 14. My own desire, right? From my own heart, my own mind. It's something that I have created, that I've given birth to. And so that's why I'm held guilty for it. And so when we go to 1 Corinthians chapter 11... we talk about this in regard to the Lord's Supper, but I think this application lies whether we're in worship. Actually, I don't think in worship is the time to have dealt with this question. I think we should come in already have dealt with this, but he does say, in partaking the Lord's Supper, let a person, verse 28, 1 Corinthians 11, 28, let a person examine himself, then, and so eat of the bread and drink of the cup. All right, so he said, you know, that's something we need to be dealing with. Am I in God's grace or am I out? Where am I weak? Where are the danger signs? Is it easier to crawl out of sin, or is it easier to be proactive in putting safeguards in our life before we get into that position? Which is easier? I think it's easier putting the safeguards. When we get mired in sin, that's very difficult. And that's why we how often do we see a Christian who's gone deep into sin return back? Not often enough. And we need to continue to pray for them and reach out to them, but it gets very hard. But if we're proactive on this side in our own lives, about guarding ourselves, about being honest about those places where we're weak, it's going to help us to remain faithful. If you go on to, read verse 31. I want to encapsulate this, but 1 Corinthians 11, 31. But if we judged ourselves truly, we would not be judged. What is he saying there? Is he saying we can get out of judgment?
Basically, watch what we didn't.
Yeah, it's being prepared for judgment, right? And so, again, just being honest with ourselves. Romans chapter 6. Romans chapter 6, verse 12. As a Christian, remember, we talked about this Sunday evening, and this was the chapter we examined, but he begins the chapter by discussing what? Our conversion to Christ, right? And what's the object lesson going on in chapter 6, those first verses? What's that now? That's how he starts it, right? He asks the rhetorical question, should we continue in sin that grace may abound? His obvious answer is what? Certainly not. God forbid. How can we who died to sin live any longer? And so in verses 1 through 14, the kind of illustration he's trying to make is, as Christians, we should have died to sin. And so that should be our mindset. I'm dead to sin, I'm alive to Christ. And so I'm going to make Christ my focus and objective. And so he says in verse 12, or he writes, let not sin therefore reign in your mortal bodies to make you obey its passions. Do not present your members as instruments of sin for unrighteousness, but present yourselves to God as those who have been brought from death to life, and your members to God as instruments for righteousness. And that should be our objective. Am I an instrument for righteousness? What does that mean to you? What you think about that phrase, instrument of righteous? What is an instrument of righteous? To do good works. Okay. Colossians 3:16, right? 17. Whatever you do in word or deed, do what? To the glory of God, right? That should be our desire. That should be the outcome of our life. It should be, people should see glory of God in us, right? They should be able to look at our lives and see God. Do they? I hope so. So be honest with yourself about where you're weak. You know, look at those places. Is that going to be comfortable?
No.
I'm not asking you to tell anybody else. You don't have to broadcast it, but you should at least sit down and have a session by yourself and say, hey, okay, let me see. Where do I need to work the most? What are the things that are the most challenging for me? And we can make that our objective. To overcome. All right, so be honest. Number two, don't be tangled with the world, but with God. Don't be tangled with the world. 1 Corinthians 15:33. This is one I used to hear a lot when I was a kid. What does it say? Do not be deceived. And he quotes this proverb of the day, bad company ruins good morals. I mean, that's as true as it was in the garden. You know, what led Eve into her sin? Her association, right? She'd not listened to him. She'd walked away. You know, maybe things are different. But she chose to listen. Are we tangling ourselves with the world? What are some ways you think that might display itself in somebody's life? How might you see somebody entangled with the world, a Christian, like that? Okay. Look at your relationships. Who are you closest to? Right? Where do you go to for counsel and advice? I mean, if you're having a difficult time, there's something going on in your life and you're having to make a tough choice, and the person you run to is not a Christian, should you expect God's advice to come out of their mouth? No, I don't think so, right? Better be careful with that. We should look at who we're hanging out with. Any other ways you think we get entangled by the world? Also, I agree. What are some places maybe we Christians ought not to venture?
Bars is the one that's coming to my head.
Kind of the road answer.
I was the first one that always to say, well, how am I supposed to reach people if I don't go where the sand is? But that was living a very dangerous line, and it did not work out well for me. So in my mind as 46 versus 16.
So there's some obvious places that we should avoid as Christians, right? But does this necessarily have to be a place of corruption?
No.
Or maybe we're just not where we should be. We're somewhere else.
Let me. To visit another people invite you to their congregation for whatever it is, and if they're denominated, that to me is the wrong place to be.
Okay.
Because you're somewhere you know you don't know. It'll be the same as being in the market.
Yeah. Well, give a couple of examples I can think of, then you can add to it if you want to. Golf course, perfectly fine place to be on a Monday, right? But on a Sunday morning when worship's going on, is that a good place to be? Has anything changed in the nature of the golf course? No, it's how it's affecting you and where you should be. What about... is anything wrong getting along with your coworkers?
No.
Nothing wrong with that. But what if I'm hanging out with a coworker of the opposite sex? At times I shouldn't be hanging out with them alone. Is that a good deal?
No.
I don't think that's a good deal. What about hanging out with coworkers, maybe the same sex, but they're wanting to go out and hang out after work and let's go have a little drink. Or let's go see this movie that maybe as a Christian you wouldn't go to because they pressure you go, right? Theater, anything wrong with going to the theater in general? No. But are there times we shouldn't be there, right? And so it's not just about the place itself. It's about what is the outcome of what we're doing. And so we need to think about those things. We need to be careful not to entangle ourselves with the world. You know, a good example of this from the Bible would be Demas in 2 Timothy 4:10. Demas is a young man who was a fellow worker of Paul, who Paul had commended at times. But then, as he wrote his second epistle to Timothy, he gives us a different picture, doesn't he? Of what happens? Verse 10. For Demas, in love, this is the English Standard Translation, in love with this present world, has deserted me. We're not given any more detail other than that, but that one statement, that he's in love with the present world, is that a good thing to be stated? His entanglement had become a problem, hadn't it? And it can become a problem for us. 1 John chapter 2 and verse 15, John says in his first epistle, 1 John 2:15, do not love the world or the things in the world. This is something I'm guilty of, but we've tried to teach the boys and I'm trying to teach myself. You know, sometimes we throw around the word love. Man, I just love living in Sanford. Man, I love my house. I love to go fishing, or well, not anymore, but just kidding.
Bless you, brother.
Just kidding. But we throw those words around, or we throw that word around. Our intention is not to say this, but where should our affections be? We need to have a priority list, and who needs to be at the top?
Well, you can say, I love pizza, and then turn around and tell your son, I love you. Well, do you love me like you love pizza, or does it mean something a little more?
So what do you automatically have to do? You got to qualify it. You know?
The Greeks had it right, have different words for different types of
agape.
But the point here is our affections, right? What did Jesus say in Matthew 6 about your treasure?
Yeah.
Don't store them up on earth where moth and rust come in and destroy, where thieves break in and steal. But lay up for yourself treasures in heaven where moth and rust aren't going to destroy, where thieves cannot break into that place and steal. For where your heart is, or for where your treasure is, there your heart will be. Let me quote that correctly. Where your treasure is. And so what do you treasure? What is it that drives you? We need to be careful not to get entangled with the world. And then number three, and finally, I think as we think about safeguards in our life, we need to be proactive in seeking opportunities to strengthen and grow spiritually. Now, this isn't the examination part. We've already done that. But here, we're actually seeking opportunities to grow in our faith. So what would that look like in your mind?
The gospel meeting coming up this weekend, it may not be commanded to attend, but it is an opportunity for growth.
Okay, that's good. Yes, ma'am.
Growing as an encourager. Yes.
What's that? I'm sorry.
Growing as an encourager.
Okay. Just trying to stretch it out. Trying to stretch yourself maybe a little bit, encouraging other people. I think that's...
For a lot of people to do that. There's a lot of different ways you can grow as an encourager.
Absolutely. Any other ways? Teresa, did you raise... Oh. Any other ways you can think of? What are some other opportunities we seek after to grow?
Become best friends with your Christian...
Instead of looking at it just from the negative about who are my friends, we purposely seek out Christian friends and building those relationships. And that's going to take some work, isn't it? Is it easy being a friend, not superficial friend, but a deep...
There's an acquaintance and a true friend. Mm-hmm. You've got two things. Either you're an acquaintance or you're a friend.
And unfortunately, there's more people in the world than there are in the church. And every day on our jobs and in our everyday life, we're surrounded by more people that are not in the church. And so the opportunity there is to teach, but the opportunity to associate with other Christians is less. So
yeah.
It takes more of an effort to... You know, when your other Christians are working in families, you know, 5 days a week, mm-hmm. You guys work 5 days a week, you're just around other people more, unless you're fortunate enough to work with other Christians.
It is kind of crazy when you do the time. So if you take out, you get all the time in your life and you break it down into hours, and then you take out your sleep time, right? You've cut all that in half. And then you then break it down into time with the church, time with the family, time with work. Which of those, for most people, far outweighs the other?
Work.
The people you work with, for most people, is far outweighs our time at home and in church. And so it does become an effort. And so the other way to look at this is, too, is some of us have really close friends with people who aren't members of the church. Maybe another proactive way to do this is to seek out an opportunity to win them to Christ. And don't allow, just because it's comfortable, to allow that friendship to just continue as it is. But to try to be that light in their life by actually bringing them to Christ. But that's uncomfortable, because you may have to have an awkward conversation or two. It may feel awkward to you. It may not be even awkward to the other person, but you may actually have to bring up Jesus.
That's where you need to know Scripture, because you're going to have to use it.
Absolutely. Just in this line of thinking, James kind of mentions this, doesn't he? In James 2 and verse 22. I got 21 up there. If you go to 22, he says, or he writes, "You see that faith was active." I like that word. "Along with his works." Faith was what? Made perfect or completed by his works. Right? And so the natural outcome of true Christian faith is what? Producing something in your life, right? You're producing some fruit in your life for Christ. I'll just leave you with this one here. Matthew 7. I like what Jesus has to say here. And this is a good, this kind of goes with our first one as well, our first point. But he says, Matthew 7:17. So every healthy tree bears good fruit, but the diseased tree bears bad fruit. A healthy tree cannot bear bad fruit, nor can a diseased tree bear good fruit. I like that word diseased. You may have a different word like bad or something like that. But that word disease, there's a disease going on when we're not producing any fruit in our life. And so there may need to be some treatment done to that tree, right? We might need to be more proactive and see, searching out a cure. He says, verse 19, every tree that does not bear good fruit is cut down and thrown into the fire. Thus, you will be recognized, you will recognize them by their fruits. And so we think about what fruits are we producing in our lives on a daily basis. What are we producing? I'll give you just a few questions here to think about. What kind of effort are you making to grow in your faith? Are you making any effort? If not, let me urge you to begin to make effort. If you're making effort, continue on. Don't stop. How have you helped the church in its work? Right? So if you were to disappear today, would you be missed? That's a scary one, isn't it? Would the church miss your effort? I hope so. We'd miss you. Are you leading someone to the knowledge of the gospel truth? That's another big one, isn't it? Is there somebody in your life you're working on? I think it would be a good habit for all of us to at least write down one name, keep it in our Bible, somebody we're praying for, somebody we're making earnest effort. It'd be good to begin to make plans for how can I reach this person? What would be the best way to get to them? And if you were to keep it there at the forefront of your mind, write it somewhere that's off. Write it down and put it on a mirror so that every morning when you went to comb your beautiful locks of hair, you'd think about that person every day. They need you doing that for them. And then finally, and most penetrating, is God pleased with your effort? It doesn't matter if I'm pleased or anybody else. I don't count. But God does. And God knows what no one else can see or know. Is God pleased with where you are? If he's not, we probably all be challenged at times to say he may not be very happy with me. It doesn't have to stay that way. That can change. And it can change today. We don't have to put it off. We don't have to plan for it. It can begin today. And so may we all be encouraged to make those changes. Any questions or comments before we close this out? All right, so we're going to move. I'll give Si a chance to transition us back there. We're going to talk about instruments of music in our worship and how we might be challenged with that. If you give me just a minute here and to change my...
That's a pure question. We don't have any, Brent.
All right, so this next question is one that we hear often in debates, and so I want to deal with it. We've dealt with it before, but we'll deal with this one as well. Musical instruments of worship. Now, there may even be many Christians who struggle with this one. I've heard Christians struggle with this one. They wonder why we don't. We need to know a biblical answer to that. And again, you don't care what I say or think, but we do want to look at the Bible. And so as we do, there are a few questions I want to look at. Number one, why do we not use musical instruments in our worship? Why do we not? I meant to put the word "use" there. So y'all just go ahead and put that in. I'll do a little edit. But why do we not use musical instruments in our worship? Can I go to the Old Testament for authority for musical instruments in our worship? What does the New Testament say about music in our worship or in the worship of the church? And then finally, we're going to deal with what about the historical reference to music in the church? And then we're going to deal with each of those questions today and into next week. So, looking at that first one, why do we not use musical instruments in our worship? That's kind of what we're looking at. Now, there are many who, even like I said, in the church who struggle with this one. And we've seen churches, congregations, fall into the use of musical instruments. Some have even gone as far as to change the name on their sign because they are upset at this and the fact that we teach that you should not. Well, that's what I want to spend some time looking at as we move forward. And so you have those who asked, you know, is this right? Is it biblical? Well, is it? Well, the first question I really want to examine is, where should we look to discover God or what God has authorized? That word authority is important, isn't it? When you hear the word authority, what does that mean to you?
Someone's in charge.
Someone's in charge? Is authority important in our lives? Is it important in the church?
Yes.
When we look at the Old Testament and we ask the question, can I go to the Old Testament to prove what I want? There are definitely references in the Old Testament to the use of musical instruments. I'm not debating that. Now, whether they were authorized in the moment, that's another debate, and I'm not going to get out in this. I know David used instruments. I think there's a question there whether he was doing what was authorized or not, but that's really not important for this debate, at first at least. We do see it, so does that prove that it's okay? Well, I want to look at a couple of texts here. And I think what they clearly teach us is that the Old Testament is not our authority to answer biblical questions. And I think there people who try to bring in the Old Testament are disingenuous about this issue anyway. And the reason why is there are a lot of things in the Old Testament that they would not agree with and they would not want. And yet they go and they pick that one issue as important. And as we've noted earlier in our studies in this particular class, is that if I'm a Gentile, I've never been under the Old Testament. It's never been authoritative over me. And so there's no need for me to go there into the law of Moses to prove that anyway. Now, and so I want to look at a couple of texts in line with this. So let's go to Colossians chapter 2. And this is the debate under which Paul's discussing is the use of the old law in regard to Christian faith. When you go to Colossians 2, what is Paul debating? What's the issue in the New Testament church that's under discussion or under dispute? What?
Circumcision,
but what about it? That's true. Circumcision in what regard? Who should
the
be?
The Gentile Christians.
Okay, and that's an issue that you see in several New Testament books. You go to Ephesians or you go to Galatians, right? This issue of circumcision comes up, And what was going on is you had some, as it's identified in the Bible, some Judaizing Christians who are trying to impose upon Gentile Christians regulations of the law of Moses, like circumcision. And they were teaching that it was necessary to be approved by God to be circumcised. And so Paul is dealing with that issue when we get into chapter 2 of Colossians. So let's go to verse 12. He writes, he says, "Put on then, as God's chosen ones, holy and beloved." Oh, wait, I'm reading the wrong one. Sorry, wrong chapter. Let me go back a chapter. I found it. Here we are. Let me back up. I want to go to verse 11. All right, so in him, Christ, also you were circumcised with a circumcision made without hands. So that's the debates over circumcision. So he's going to give you a different idea here about circumcision in regard to Christian faith. So you were circumcised with a circumcision made without hands by putting off the body of the flesh and by the circumcision of Christ. So, number one, before we go on to verse 12, what does that phrase, a circumcision made without hands, what does that infer about his point? How is he speaking about this? In fleshly terms or spiritual terms?
Spiritual, without hands.
Okay, that without hands denotes the idea that what he's talking about is not something physical, but it's something done to the spirit of the soul, all right? So, verse 12. Having been buried with him in baptism. Now, what he just said, if you back up to verse 11, he says, by putting off the body of the flesh. So, in physical circumcision, you're cutting off a part of the body, right? There is that removal of flesh. Well, here he says there has been another removal, but what does he mean? How when we become a Christian, is there some kind of putting off of the flesh? That's what he's going to speak about in verse 12. Having been buried with him in baptism, in which you were also raised with him through faith in the powerful working of God who raised him from the dead. So he's talking about our baptism into Christ. When we became Christians, what happened? We died to our old selves. Romans chapter 6, we were buried with him in the water, and then when we came back up, what happened? A new man was born. So did you look different after you came out physically? So when he says a new man, what's he talking about?
Spiritual.
You're spiritually changed. There's some, yes. And so he says, we were raised with him through faith in the powerful working of God, who raised him from the dead. So same way God raised Jesus, he raised us. And you who were dead in your trespasses, prior to becoming Christian, you were dead in your trespasses, and the uncircumcision of your flesh. So if you're a Gentile Christian, prior to becoming Christian, you're dead, right, in your sin. You're also not a part of the Israelite family of God, are you? So in two ways, you're kind of dead to God. However, God made alive together with him. So this person who was dead in sin and the uncircumcision of their flesh has now been what?
Joined with God.
Joined with God, made alive with Christ. So now this dead person is alive. Having forgiven us all our trespasses. Now how did he do that? By canceling the record of the debt that stood against us with its legal demands. This he set aside, nailing it to the cross. So what was nailed to the cross? The law, right? Whether you were under the law of Moses or you're under the patriarchal law, whatever law you were judged under as a sinner, that law has been nailed to the cross. It, when Jesus cried out, "It is finished," what did he mean?
The law
and all that it had been leading up to had reached its end. And so when Jesus rose on Sunday morning, what did that mean? A new covenant was born. The old covenant was done away with. And so in his obedience to the cross, not only did he provide a way for salvation for us from sin, but he also provided a salvation from the law, whether that's the patriarchal or the Mosaic law. And so you get in this same discussion, he's continuing to discuss this, but now in Galatians, he says in chapter 5, and there were those Christians who were trying to bring in parts of that Old Testament law. Notice what he says about those who try to incorporate Old Testament law with New Covenant Christianity. Go to Galatians 5 and verse 2. Look, I, Paul, say to you that if you accept circumcision, that's what they're trying to bring in, right? Christ will be of no advantage to you. I testify again to every man who accepts circumcision that he is obligated to keep the whole law. You have again become one under law and not under grace. And he says so much in verse 4, doesn't he? You are severed from Christ, you who would be justified by the law, you have what?
Fallen
from grace. So you can't be both a Jew in the sense of a religious Jew adhering to the Mosaic law and a Christian. It's one or the other, right? And there's only salvation in one. And so the New Testament is our authority in all things religiously and in doctrine and faith. And so the Old Testament is not a place you and I can go to for direction in how we should live. That is the last bell. Next week, we're going to move into the actual discussion of music and how is it seen in the New Testament. Any questions before I close? All right. You can be thinking about that over the week, and we'll look forward.